Welcome to the CancerCare Connect workshop. At this time, all participant lines are in listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at CancerCare. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Trinitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's CancerCare Connect workshop, the latest developments reported at the 34th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And I know that many of you have been waiting for this workshop, it's an opportunity for you to learn about the latest research and information that's been presented at the symposium. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between CancerCare and many other cancer organizations. And it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 783 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions of the United States and cities and towns and from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Iran, Sudan, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from CancerCare. In those materials, there is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be covering. And there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for all of you to have. And, of course, there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. You know, your feedback is critically important to us as we plan programs. This is the beginning of 2012, and we're planning many programs, and, indeed, this particular program we've been doing for all these many years because of your consistent feedback to say, please keep doing this program. So please tell us what you want us to do, and we try very hard to really meet your needs and your expectations of what you'd like us to do. Today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Friends of Cancer Care, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our workshop today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Julie Grelow. Dr. Grelow is Professor of Medical Oncology, Director of Breast Medical Oncology, University of Washington School of Medicine, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. She's a member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Dr. Grelow is going to present an overview of breast cancer and the research findings reported at the symposium. She's going to discuss biomarkers, targeted treatments, and new diagnostic technologies, and discuss also early-stage breast cancer treatment. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Grelow.
Thank you, Carolyn. The 2011 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, which was held this past December, was really very exciting with some important data, and we'll review some of the most clinically relevant data with you today. I think that the theme of the meeting, which has become increasingly the theme of how do we treat and manage breast cancer, is that breast cancer is no longer one size fits all. There are lots of different subtypes of breast cancer, and we've had a focus on kind of more specific and more personalized therapies targeting to the individual patient and the individual breast cancer. We've seen some benefits with improved therapies that have better effectiveness, meaning less recurrences or longer survival, and also less side effects. And another theme of the meeting was a focus on how to give less treatment. Who can we omit radiation therapy or chemotherapy in and still get the same excellent results with a lot less side effects? So I'd first like to review four important abstracts that focus on one major target, and that target is bone. The class of drugs that's been investigated in this area is called the bisphosphonates, and these are drugs that inhibit bone breakdown by targeting cells in the bone, predominantly a class of cells called osteoclasts that chew up bone. Bone is the most common site of a distant breast cancer recurrence when it recurs, and so by interfering with the interaction between breast cancer cells that try to migrate and survive in the bone and the actual bone environment, we've hoped in early stage breast cancer to reduce recurrence. We had seen a few prior studies that showed some benefit for this class of drugs, the bisphosphonates, an early study with the most recent reporting in 2006 for a benefit in reducing recurrences and deaths in early-stage breast cancer from an oral drug called cladrenate. We also saw more recently studies with a drug called zoledronic acid in reducing recurrences in an Austrian breast cancer study. And then we had, to confuse it all, a very negative study presented at the San Antonio meeting in 2010 called the Azure study for a more intensive zoledronic acid dosing. So what did we see at the 2011 San Antonio meeting? We had four abstracts that looked at this idea. The first was an update with longer follow-up of that Austrian study. It's called the ABCSG12 study, abstract S1-2. This was a study of premenopausal women, with all of whom had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, and all of them received essentially just hormonal therapy, not chemo. With 84 months of follow-up, now we took a look at what was happening with recurrences and deaths. So the basic theme behind the trial was that all patients had their ovaries shut down. They were all premenopausal, but they all got a drug called Gozerolin or Zoladex for 3 years to shut down their ovaries. They were randomized to tamoxifen or anastrozole. There was no difference between those two arms. And then they were randomized to zoledronic acid, this bisphosphonate given intravenously every 6 months or not for 3 years. With 84-month follow-up, we saw a 27% reduction in recurrences and a 41% reduction in deaths. This was the first time we had seen reduced deaths due to adding this drug. And the most benefit seemed to be in women who were 40 years of age or older. All of them were premenopausal in the study. So we saw a benefit, not just a reduction in recurrences, but a reduction in deaths. The next study, the ZOFAST study, abstract S1-3, was also looking at zoledronic acid in women receiving hormonal therapy, but this time it was postmenopausal women. They all had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. They were all postmenopausal, and they were all receiving an aromatase inhibitor called letrozole or Femara. Half of them got zoledronic acid, just one IV infusion every 6 months for 3 years, and half essentially did not. And with about 5 years of follow-up, the ZOFAST study showed about a 34% reduction in recurrences. And for an older group of women, women who were over 60 or who had been in menopause 5 years or more, they also reported less deaths. Events in this study were low in both groups, however. Most of the women in both the Austrian study and the ZOFAST study hadn't had a recurrence or a death. So we had a lot of enthusiasm, two positive trials, and then we had two negative trials for this idea. The B34 study, abstract S2-3, was a mix of pre- and postmenopausal patients, a mix of estrogen receptor positive and negative breast cancer. Two-thirds of the patients got chemotherapy, and these patients were randomized back to cladrenate, which was one of the first studies that we saw quite a while ago potentially showing a benefit, versus a placebo for 3 years. With 8 years of follow-up, we saw a very low event rate, meaning there were hardly any relapses or deaths, which is great news for patients. We also saw that 40% of patients didn't complete the planned 3 years of study treatment, despite the fact that side effects were similar between the placebo and the cladrenate, and the rate wasn't different between the two. Women just didn't like taking a pill every day. And at 8 years of follow-up, there was no difference at all between recurrences in the group that got cladrenate or placebo. A kind of post hoc unplanned analysis showed a trend toward benefit for patients who were older, but it wasn't pre-planned, so that's just hypothesis generating. And then the last bisphosphonate trial, again a negative trial, was a German trial called the GAIN trial, G AIN, abstract S2-4. Again, a mix of pre- and postmenopausal patients, a mix of estrogen receptor positive or negative breast cancer. They were all lymph node positive. They all got aggressive chemo with both anthracycline and taxane. And the primary study was actually a randomization between two different kinds of chemo. That hasn't reported yet. But a second randomization was abandronate, another bisphosphonate, taken daily for 2 years versus observation. In 3,000 patients, we saw that there was no difference in disease-free survival between the abandronate arm or not. So to quickly sum up those four studies, we saw something positive, and we saw some studies that were just flat out no different. But what was unique about the studies that seemed to have some benefit for the bisphosphonates was that all the patients were estrogen receptor positive, all had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer in the two studies that were positive. In the two positive studies for benefit from bisphosphonate, there was very limited chemotherapy given, and for the most part, the patients were postmenopausal or had ovarian suppression. Now, there's lots of ongoing studies to try to sort this out further and to figure out who with early stage breast cancer might benefit. We have the S0307 trial that I've run comparing quadrinate to abandronate to zoledronic acid. That hasn't reported yet. And then we have some trials looking at a new drug that targets bone called denosumab. It's a RANK ligand inhibitor, a different class of bone-targeted therapy. Now, in my last couple of minutes, I'll discuss two more abstracts quickly on a totally different area. One is looking at delivering radiation therapy, and one is looking at patients with DCIS. So the radiation trial that I wanted to highlight is a trial looking at brachytherapy or accelerated partial breast radiation. This was abstract S2-1. This partial breast radiation has become increasingly popular, but really there's been a lack of data regarding toxicity or effectiveness. The randomized trials are going on right now. So this group looked at 130,000 Medicare patients diagnosed between 2000 and 2007, and they looked at those who had invasive breast cancer who got breast conservation with then added partial breast radiation, this brachytherapy, or those who got breast conservation, meaning a lumpectomy, with whole breast radiation, which is the standard. And their definition of a failure was if these patients started with breast conservation, how many of them down the line over time got a mastectomy on that breast? That would imply that they had had a relapse. And what they saw was the group that got brachytherapy, the partial breast radiation, had a higher likelihood of later on needing a mastectomy on that side. It was 4% versus 2% if they got standard breast radiation, but also importantly, there were more complications in the group that got brachytherapy, including hospitalizations, infections, rib fracture, and breast pain. That was higher if you got partial breast radiation versus the classic whole breast. So the conclusion of this study was we need to wait for more mature results of clinical trials comparing these two before we just jump into giving this routinely. Now, the last abstract is for patients who got diagnosed with DCIS, and it's trying to form a kind of a biomarker, a gene view of who needs radiation and who doesn't if you're diagnosed with DCIS. So this is looking at a modified version of a genomic profiling assay called the 21 gene recurrence score assay or the Oncotype DX assay. And the parent study was a study called E5194 where they took patients with DCIS. And there were a couple different strata they could fall into, but generally they needed to have all of the DCIS excised, no DCIS at the margins, and they all had lumpectomy, and none of the patients in this study got radiation. Halfway through, they allowed tamoxifen to be added because tamoxifen got approved in the treatment of DCIS, so some of them got tamoxifen. They were able to get the tumor blocks on about half the women in this study. They ran this modified version of this 21 gene profiling assay. And what they found was that based on gene expression of the DCIS, they could sort patients into a low, an intermediate, and a high-risk group for the future development of a recurrence of either DCIS or invasive breast cancer in that same breast. So remember, they all had lumpectomy. None of them got radiation. And this gene assay was able to pick out 75% of these patients who had a low chance of having a future recurrence in that breast. So they did well without having the radiation added. And then it found another about 25% who fell into intermediate and high-risk groups who had almost a 25% risk of a relapse of cancer with the omission of radiation. So the conclusion of this study is that not all patients with DCIS who get a lumpectomy need radiation, but a question that I ask is, do we really need to use the score, which is available now, but it costs over $3,000, or are there other ways of picking out which DCIS patients don't need radiation? So with that whirlwind review of the topics I was assigned, I will hand it back to you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grelo, for that really whirlwind and actually very comprehensive and really outstanding presentation and really starting off this whole workshop. So thank you so much. Lots of wonderful information, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Generosa Grana. Dr. Grana is Director, Breast Cancer Program, Cooper Hospital, UMC. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson School of Medicine. Now, Dr. Grana is going to address advances in the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, communicating with your healthcare team about your treatment and your treatment side effects, and metabolism, exercise, and diet. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Grana.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I am going to talk about primarily the treatment of metastatic disease and chose some of the abstracts that are important that highlight three areas. The first is new therapies in patients that are HER2-new positive. Trastuzumab or Herceptin has been the mainstay of treatment in advanced breast cancer for these patients, but this is an area of tremendous excitement with lots of new drugs being tested. I'm going to talk about new approaches for hormone-positive disease, primarily postmenopausal disease, but again, some interesting data. And I'll just touch base on a little bit regarding PARP inhibitors and the approach to triple-negative disease. Key to all of these abstracts, however, is the important message that the decision of what treatment is right for any woman entails really a great discussion between herself and her team to determine what her priorities are, what toxicities are acceptable to her and not, and what her long-term goals are. So I think that should underpin each of these abstracts. So let's begin talking about HER2-new positive disease. As all of you know, trastuzumab or Herceptin is really the backbone of that disease. And in metastatic disease, it's used with a variety of chemotherapy drugs. There's used together with a non-chemotherapy drug, Tykerb or lapatinib. So the combination of these two HER2-new targeted agents is very active. And now we are seeing a whole new array of drugs that are in the testing process, that are being tested in advanced disease, in the neoadjuvant or preoperative setting, as well as in the adjuvant setting. The most interesting compounds are T-DM1, which is a conjugate, pertuzumab, which is a monoclonal antibody very similar to Herceptin, two oral compounds, Tykerb or lapatinib, and neratinib. And the question is, what will these compounds do to this complex pathway? And also, other compounds, bevacizumab or Avastin, what is its role in this pathway? To look at this issue, there were four studies that I chose to look at. The first is the CLEOPATRA study, a trial that took really a very standard backbone docetaxel or taxotere plus trastuzumab, and it looked at that combination versus that combination with the addition of pertuzumab, so you're targeting the HER2-new pathway with two compounds versus one. And what the study showed, which led to tremendous excitement, was the fact that if you look at these patients' progression-free survival, the period of time between initiation of therapy and progression of disease, was improved by 6 months in the patients that added the pertuzumab. The median time was 12 months versus 18 months before a change in therapy was needed, or approximately a 40% improvement. This is quite exciting in that patient population. The other thing that was improved was the responses. Not complete responses were low in both groups. 4 to 5% of patients will have complete disappearance of disease, but objective measurable responses were improved, 69% versus 80%. And this was with moderate toxicity. The major worry, which is cardiac toxicity, was similar, 1 to 1.5% in both groups. The added toxicity of pertuzumab was slight diarrhea, a rash, some fever and low white count, some skin changes, but in general, tolerable toxicity. So again, this is a drug that's going to be studied in other scenarios. It's not a drug that's on the market at this point, but it is a compound that has great promise in the HER2-positive patient population. The next abstract was the Averil study, and it really took that same backbone, Taxotere and the trastuzumab, and it added a compound that you've heard a lot, that's been in the media a lot, Avastin or bevacizumab. And so the question becomes, if you add a compound that targets a different pathway, can you improve outcome? And you can. There was an improvement in progression-free survival from approximately 13-plus months to 16-plus months, depending on whether it was data reviewed by the investigators or by an outside panel. There was significance, but overall survival was no different between the addition of the bevacizumab versus not. Responses were very similar. So I must say that my enthusiasm for that combination was not as significant as my enthusiasm for the pertuzumab combination, and I think the jury is still very much out as to what Avastin's role is going to be in metastatic disease, whether it be HER2-positive or HER2-negative disease. Finally, the other trial that was presented was a trial comparing two oral regimens. One was neratinib, which is an oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor, versus what many people consider a standard cocktail of Tykerb, lapatinib, with the addition of capecitabine or Xeloda. So again, the study was comparing two oral regimens, either the single agent neratinib or the combination cocktail, and there was an improvement in the response rates were very similar. There was a very similar effectiveness, and again, as a single agent, neratinib did not play up to a great significant impact. Had some toxicity that was manageable, but I don't think as a single agent it's going to be changing the management of this disease. In other meetings that have happened this past year, there has been data presented on T-DM1, and that compound is making its way through the clinical testing pathway. So I think at this point, it's a very exciting time to address HER2-positive disease, and I foresee that in the next year we're going to have some new drugs that will change how we approach this disease and this patient population. Now, changing altogether, let's talk about hormonal therapy. And there were three interesting areas that were addressed in the hormone therapy pathway. The first was the concept of overcoming hormone resistance. Bolero 2 was a study that was presented by Dr. Hortabaji and his collaborators. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that same week at San Antonio. And it took a group of patients that had been on prior hormonal therapy with aromatase inhibitors, either Arimidex or Letrozole, and then assigned those patients to a very common agent, aromicin or exemestane, and either that agent alone or that agent with everolimus, Afinitor, as some of you will know that drug, as it's used in renal cell carcinoma. Afinitor is an mTOR inhibitor, and the concept is that this inhibition of this pathway will help overcome hormone resistance. The data was very interesting. If you look at the number of patients that were treated, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival. If you look at the central review versus the local review, the progression-free survival went from 4 months for the patients that received the exemestane alone to 11 months for the patients that received the combination. This is quite a significant improvement. If you look at patients responding, and those patients had much more responses in the group that had the combination therapy, but if you look at those patients that got clinical benefit, it doubled. So 25% of the patients that were on the single agent aromacin had a clinical benefit versus 50% for the patients that were on the combination arm. So again, a very significant impact. The other important thing for this trial was that all groups of patients received benefit, whether the patient had gotten previous tamoxifen or not, whereas in one prior study looking at this agent, there was a suggestion that the benefit was seen in the patients that were hormone resistant. The question that comes up and why communication between a patient and her care team is so important is that as you add some of these new compounds, you do increase the toxicity profile. You take the ease of a hormonal agent and you definitely increase the GI symptoms, the rash, fatigue, mouth. So ultimately, when this drug becomes available for breast cancer, it's not yet FDA approved for breast cancer, the decision of whether to use aromacin alone or the decision of whether to use this combination will really need to be an intelligent discussion between the team. The next study that was looked at in hormonal therapy was a study that was run out of SWOG, Dr. Grelo's group, and it looked at the combination of two hormonal agents. Traditionally, we use hormonal agents alone. In the early stage breast cancer trial ATTACK, there was no suggestion of benefit when tamoxifen and Arimidex were used together. But again, that's a topic of interest. So in this particular study, two hormonal agents were used, anastrozole, Arimidex, and fulvestrant, Faslodex. So it was either the combination or Arimidex alone. And what we saw was, again, an improvement in outcome, so that the group that received the combination had an improvement in time to progression, and the benefit was really primarily seen in the patients that had never gotten tamoxifen therapy. In those patients that had gotten previous tamoxifen, there was no significant difference. This makes sense because the reality is that fulvestrant is very similar to tamoxifen in terms of mechanism of action. So again, I think it's an interesting combination and something that will deserve much more attention. Toxicity was very similar across both groups. There was not marked change in toxicity profile, and I think this will be something that will be evolving. Finally, in the hormonal therapy area, there was a study that really is very early in its development, but there's a new class of compounds called HDAC inhibitors, and histone deacetylase inhibitors are evolving in a variety of diseases. We know that vorinostat is approved for lymphomas. The concept that the coiling and uncoiling of DNA around its histones will lead to different gene expression has been studied in a lot of different diseases. And again, in estrogen receptor positive disease, this is being studied. So the concept of using one of these compounds, entinostat, in patients that were estrogen receptor positive was looked at. The combination of exemestane, aromacin, with entinostat versus aromacin alone was looked at, and you did see an improvement, although it was modest. You did see an improvement in progression-free survival, and the tolerable profile was seen. So clearly this is something that needs much more work, but we are beginning to learn how to deal with this estrogen receptor pathway in a variety of ways, and I think we'll see much more data evolving. Finally, I'm going to leave with just two mention, really, of two other trials. One is a topic that's been of a tremendous interest to the patients that are triple negative, particularly to the patients that are triple negative and mutation positive. And there was a study out of the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. Dr. Graylo was the senior author. Dr. Rodler was the first author. And the data looked at cisplatinum in combination with veliparib, one of the PARP inhibitors, in triple negative breast patients. And again, very interesting data showing that although the number of patients presented was small, you really saw very nice partial response rates and very good stable disease. So we are going to need to continue to look at that data. The NCI has a trial currently ongoing looking at a PARP inhibitor with chemotherapy in mutation-positive women. So this is an area that will be the subject of a lot more ongoing research. There was also a trial looking at the mTOR inhibitor in combination with cisplatinum and Taxol that showed activity. So again, we are going to be seeing research that's going to be incorporating some of these new compounds, and ultimately the disease will change. Again, I come back to one of the messages that I was given, which is to talk about communication, and I think communication is key to determining what therapy to choose for any particular woman, but also to discuss management of toxicity, because a team can be very helpful in terms of dealing with toxicity only if they know that it's happening. So I'll stop here.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Grana, for a wonderful presentation and very informative and really covering a wide variety of areas that I know will prompt questions during the Q&A. Thank you very much. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira, and Dr. Shapira is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, a staff oncologist, Gillette Center for Breast Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Shapira is going to address treatment of young and older women, how clinical trials contribute to your treatment options, and quality of life concerns. Dr. Shapira?
Thank you, Carolyn. Good afternoon for those of you who are east, and it's great to have such a large audience. I am in awe of everything that was just presented and just trying to digest it, so I will start by being a bit more philosophical. I don't think I have any specific answers or news for new treatments for women based on age groups, but I do have some thoughts about what I heard in San Antonio 2011 and at other meetings about just how we can think about age as a way of helping to make an appropriate treatment decision. And the first important reminder to everybody is that new knowledge comes from good research, and we're all stakeholders in this partnership that we call clinical trials and clinical trials research. So Dr. Grana just talked about the importance of communicating one's needs with the healthcare team and being very open about both goals and also about possible side effects from treatment. And in that same venue, I think it's really important at all stages, at all junctures, to really ask if there is a clinical trial that's right for you. And by participating in a clinical trial, you may be both helping all of us generate the kind of knowledge we need in order to create new options for treatment, but also perhaps from a very personal point of view, have access to treatments that are not yet on the shelf. In the last 20 minutes, we heard about drugs that help women who have HER2 overexpressive cancers, such as T-DM1, pertuzumab, neratinib. These are not drugs that we can just pull off the shelf. These are drugs that are still considered investigational. So perhaps for those of you who have these kinds of situations and are needing to make new treatment choices or considering first-time treatment, you know, it's important perhaps to see if there is a trial that's of interest to you and that could perhaps provide some benefit or an option for you as well. It's also important for me, especially given the fact that I've been doing work in quality of life issues for many years, to remind everybody of the importance of studying quality of life issues. It's not just anecdotes that form the body of knowledge, but we've really invested a lot, and I think we've seen a maturation of quality of life studies. So they're no longer now, you know, in a separate session or presented when there's nothing left to say, but it's been very gratifying to see quality of life studies also being given the importance that they deserve. So what kinds of things am I talking about? Well, for one, the management of pain. We still have a lot of pain caused by the disease itself, and the pain very often is bone pain. So many of the drugs that Dr. Grelo mentioned that we're now also investigating perhaps earlier on in the disease trajectory have been used and have really transformed the experience of many women who've had metastases of breast cancer to bone. So this is a very important area. And then, of course, there is the enormous area that's opening up of all of the side effects and the management of the toxicities from the new treatments. So we deal with things like hair loss to neuropathy, which is very common from the drugs. And one of the things that many women and perhaps many of you on this phone call experience are the very common musculoskeletal and joint symptoms from the aromatase inhibitors. So studying these is really important, and then trying to understand perhaps how these things happen or who is most likely going to be affected or what can be done about them is enormously important. And I'll just tell you that, you know, this isn't incredible science, but it's a beginning. There were two posters, for instance, presented on things that can be done in order to minimize or prevent the hair loss, what we call alopecia from treatment. There were many studies that were done looking at how young women, for instance, make decisions about their choice of surgery and whether or not they experience regret. I can't give you generalizations, but I can give you the assurance that we are paying increasing attention to the personal cost of making these decisions, and that that will hopefully better inform the conversations we can have with our patients. With respect to special issues and considerations for the young women, again, a lot of it has to do with the fact that the disease happens at a very inconvenient time in life, when one is trying to manage perhaps many different roles or establish oneself as a professional, and often juggling also issues of parenting and many other important considerations. So there were some studies presented. Again, these aren't, these don't have the force, the statistical force that the studies presented by my colleagues, because they're not randomized trials. But there were some studies that looked at decision making and quality of life, and actually what kind of treatments are available for women who are diagnosed during pregnancy, or for young women who wish to get the best possible treatment for their cancer, but also preserve their fertility. And this is an area, again, of increasing concern, and one which needs to be discussed upfront before a treatment plan is made. So these are very important issues. One of the areas that remains active in research is just how much hormonal therapy is right for young women who have estrogen receptor positive or endocrine-driven cancers. We have many options for women whose ovaries are suppressed, but we're still struggling with figuring out how we should do it, who we should recommend this for, and how we should add the other hormonal therapies that we're so familiar with. For the older women, it's often a different set of trade-offs that need to be considered, and that has to do with how much their organs can handle. So we are, again, rethinking the aging process. Many women that we considered older when I was in training are just now middle-aged, and any of you, I imagine many of you saw the Super Bowl. If you just watched what a 53-year-old performer can do in terms of acrobatics, it certainly has changed the idea of our thinking about what a middle-aged body can do. But we are now also facing many women who are in their 70s, 80s, and even 90s who have cancer. So the question for the older women are, you know, what is the minimum amount of treatment that they really need? Will we be over-treating them if we just extrapolate from what we know about middle-aged women? Could we cause harm by giving them drugs perhaps that their bodies can't possibly get rid of in a timely fashion? Do we need to give every older woman radiation therapy, for instance, if she has an otherwise favorable, small, hormonally driven tumor. These are the kinds of questions that we've been wrestling with, and there are periodic updates that help identify just what the right amount of treatment is for older women. But I think that as we move forward, we will also perhaps find ways of giving some chemotherapy in ways that are more gentle or less toxic, of expanding options for hormonal therapies for women who have hormonally driven cancer, and perhaps even finding women who may not need radiation if their cancers are found at a very early stage and are hormonally sensitive. So I think that we are really coming to a point where we can personalize the treatment more and more based on the biology of the cancer and also the profile of the host, in this case, the woman who actually has the cancer. So her age, her preference, her organ reserve, and the kind of trade-offs that she's prepared to make are increasingly important. One of the things that I heard at this meeting that I was very excited about was that there was so much discovery in terms of new drugs, and the new drugs not just picked randomly for different patients, but based on what we can uncover from doing very sophisticated genomic analyses of the cancers. We heard a lot about new classes of drugs. You just heard about mTOR inhibitors. We've heard a whole lot about PI3 kinase inhibitors, which is an emerging class of drugs. So again, if at all possible, and if any of you are facing important treatment considerations, if it's possible to even think beyond the basics of using hormonal agents or chemotherapy, if you can expand your thinking and you have access to a team that is performing clinical trials, it's, I think, important and increasingly relevant for each one of you to ask questions about what new kinds of drugs perhaps can help you. So in order to allow time for questions, I think I'm going to stop here, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro, for just a very thoughtful and just a wonderful presentation for a lot of issues that a lot of our callers on the line are struggling with, and I know we'll have questions for you about, but these are very important issues that you raise and things that I think many women reflect upon in terms of their care. Thank you. And our next speaker is Pat Spicer, and Pat is the coordinator of our breast cancer programs at CancerCare. She's an oncology social worker, and Pat is going to go over with you the free support services offered by CancerCare. Pat?
Thank you, Carolyn. This was certainly a very exciting conference this year, and one of the things that I was particularly impressed with at the conference was the fact that there were also two studies presented dealing with the environmental factors in breast cancer, and I know that this has been a concern for women all the way along. If you have questions or concerns or you'd like to talk about what was presented today, we're happy to talk with you at CancerCare. Our telephone number is 1-800-813-4673, and we're available on a daily basis. We also have a website, www.cancercare.org, in which we list further information about the educational programs and our services that are available to you as a breast cancer patient or as a family member of a breast cancer patient. I know everybody has a long list of questions, so I won't go much further, and I'd like to thank you, Carolyn, for this wonderful conference.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, and I really, for your very warm remarks to everybody and also for letting everyone know about the services of Cancer Care. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Janitha to bring all of our speakers on board. And we're going to ask if Janitha, would you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we'll take the questions as they come in. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. For those of you on the web, you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question is from Miriam T. Your question, please.
Hi, this is Miriam from Chicago. I'm specifically asking your thoughts on duration of bisphosphonate therapy for In regards specifically to Mets to the Bone only, I've been on Zometa for 3 years and then a year of Xgeva monthly with the Cancer Control to the Bone for over 3.5 years. Do you any thoughts on tapering, keep going, stop?
Thank you. Excellent question. Dr. Grana, would you like to address that?
Oh, I think this is better with Dr. Grelo.
Oh, Dr. Grelo. Okay. Then Dr. Grelo, would you like to address this?
Sure. When the bisphosphonates are being used to manage bone metastases, the primary goal is to reduce what we call skeletal-related events, meaning a fracture, pain, need for radiation, surgery. The data really is best within the first couple of years, and we didn't do studies of very, very long durations. The good news is that patients with recurrence, when it's predominantly in the bone especially, live a long, long, long time. So these questions come up. What I would say is, in general, I would continue to treat as long as the patient is doing well. Yet we might be able to reduce the frequency at which we give the bisphosphonates from monthly to less often. There is one main ongoing study that's just about to close called the Optimize 2 study that's looking at after you've had a year of monthly zoledronic acid going on in one arm to continuing at a monthly dosing for the next year versus switching to every three-month dosing. So I think pretty soon we'll see the results of that trial. There's also an interesting trial out of the UK looking at determining the frequency of dosing, whether it's monthly or less often, based on markers of bone turnover in the blood. So the bone sends out signals in the blood that might be able to tell us, okay, the bones are quiet, you don't need to give another dose yet, or the bones are quite active, you do need to give another dose now. But we don't have the results of that study either. So right now, I generally, if things are going well and the patient isn't having any real side effects from the drug, I generally do continue it, the bisphosphonates for the treatment of bone mets indefinitely, but would consider backing off to less frequent intervals. And for the denosumab or the Xgeva that you've recently been switched to, we really don't have any long-term data on that drug. It was just approved within the last year or so. We don't have any studies that tell us what to do there, but I would probably use the same thoughts with the RANK ligand inhibitor, denosumab or Xgeva, as I would with the bisphosphonates.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants. The question, what can be done to facilitate patient involvement in obtaining clinical trial information for discussion with their medical team? And the question is actually directed at Dr. Shapira, and it comes from someone who's had a little hard time with their community physician actually getting them access to a clinical trial. So if you could say a little bit about that whole process of bringing up one's interest in a clinical trial with a community, with one's physician.
I think that's a really sticky point, because if you as the patient need to do all the work, it may feel a bit as an uphill climb. You should take a look on the web at some of the websites, maybe NCI.gov, and then there are some other websites that help you find a clinical trial. Perhaps if you search, you'll find them, cancer.net, which is ASCO's website, also should have links that help you find clinical trials. And then I think it's a matter of really having the courage to discuss it with your community oncologist and say that you'd like access to perhaps a consultation with a center that specializes in innovation and finding new treatments, and try to enlist his or her help. And if that doesn't work, perhaps see if there are advocacy groups, or perhaps if you can find somebody else to work with. But I think that you should follow your instinct. If you would like to explore the possibility of participating in a trial, you need to see where your options are.
I'd like to add, Carolyn, to that.
Yes,
Emerging
please,
Med is another good website. It's emergingmed.org, and they will do a complete profile and locate a clinical trial that might be helpful to you. Yes, sometimes it's hard to do the research, you know, and have it sort of put off on the patient. But I think there are a number of advocacy groups out there, and also the sites that are out there are really very helpful.
And definitely, of course, point of just working with a support organization like Cancer Care or any of the cancer support organizations out there to really help you in terms of those day-to-day discussions that are so hard often.
Living Beyond Breast Cancer or Why Me or Cancer Care also will offer you all kinds of information and support.
Thank you. Our next question, Trinitha.
Thank you. Our next question is from Lynn F. Your question, please.
Hi, I have two quick ones. I think they should be directed probably at Dr. Grelo. First of all, the various bisphosphonate studies that you have cited, I worry a lot about bisphosphonates, particularly IV, being utilized in early stage disease. And I think there might have been one of the four studies that cited it was more advanced disease, particularly because of the potential side effects of IV bisphosphonates. And the other one pertains to the suggestion that radiation isn't required for DCIS. I know the Oncotype DX might be employed, but I was just curious as to whether they're taking into account comedoform DCIS, the very, very high-grade DCIS, and I have a hard time imagining not having radiation follow that. So okay. Thank you for your comments.
Well, thank you. Those are two excellent questions. Dr. Grelo, do you want to address both of them?
Sure. With respect to the bisphosphonate studies that I reviewed, all four of those were in early stage disease. All four of them carefully looked at side effects, which are really quite minimal. There were a couple of cases of osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is exposed bone in the jaw that doesn't heal at a pace we'd expect it to, that were in one of the studies, but not the other three, just a couple of cases. It was about 0.5% of patients at most and not seen in the other three studies. There really wasn't any kidney toxicity, which can be another side effect from IV forms of this. The zoledronic acid used in the study that had the most benefit, the ABCSG12, as well as the ZOFA study, is just one dose every 6 months. Side effects are quite low. Compared to hormonal therapy or chemotherapy, the side effects are fewer. With respect to the DCIS question and the radiation, they did take into account grade. They looked at low and intermediate grade versus high grade. You could enter the study with omission of radiation therapy if you had high grade DCIS, where most of the comedo would fall, but you had to have less than 1 centimeter worth of DCIS, so half an inch worth of DCIS. And what they also found was that when they compared what the outside pathology group where the patient was diagnosed rated grade as, and then they collected the tumor blocks, and then they had a central review of the grade, there was a lot of variation. Grade is very subjective. Now, the point of this was that grade is not perfect or exclusive in and of itself as a way to tell about the biology and the aggressiveness of the DCIS, that looking at these various genes that were part of this genomic profiling score might be a more accurate and reproducible way. But in general, comedo DCIS, which is generally a higher grade, is more aggressive, has higher recurrence, and probably very little of the high-grade comedo DCIS would have fallen into a profile that would have allowed you to feel comfortable emitting radiation. So that gets to my question of, do you really need that score to tell you that, or can you sort it out from some of the other features of the DCIS?
Excellent. Thank you. And we do have a question, two questions about triple-negative breast cancer from an online participant, just asking if there's more information about triple-negative breast cancer, latest treatments. Dr. Grana, would you like to address that? Or?
Sure. I think it really has been a recognition of this disease over the last 5 years. Prior to that, I don't think we had the same angst or concern about this disease as we currently have because of our enhanced understanding. There definitely is a lot of research going on both in early-stage breast cancer and in metastatic disease. There's several ongoing studies in early-stage breast cancer. One is a preoperative study looking at the addition of carboplatin and the addition of Avastin. So again, can we enhance responses and can we enhance pathologic responses in that group by adding those compounds? We think of triple negative as being particularly amenable to platinum-containing compounds. Will Avastin also give us benefit in that setting? There are a couple of interesting studies looking at patients who got chemotherapy and with triple negative disease still have residual disease at the time of their surgery. So in that setting, adding platinum after the preoperative chemotherapy, adding a PARP inhibitor, one study is looking at metronomic chemotherapy and Avastin. So I think we are going to be seeing much more in the next few years. Right now, this work is ongoing. In a woman with metastatic triple negative disease, there are drugs that have activity. Avastin may have activity. Erebulin or Halaven may have activity. Ixabepilone may have activity. The platinum compounds participating in clinical trials looking at the PARP inhibitors, all of those are viable options.
Carolyn, I'd also like to state that Cancer Care has a special program available to women with triple-negative breast cancer, and if they call the 1-800 number, they can be connected to someone at the program.
Excellent. It's a wonderful program and service. Staff by our oncology social workers here at Cancer Care, and be very helpful to many of you on the call. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Natalie M. Your question, please.
Yes, I'm a 15-year survivor, and I've been trying to eat healthfully. I stopped taking calcium because of the negative things they were saying about it, and then I heard on Dr. Oz that they were looking at Gouda cheese as some.
Now your question.
Has anything been found to suggest that the cheeses such as Gouda or Jarlsberg are good for cancer patients?
Okay, well, thank you, Natalie, for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Shapiro just to address that general question about calcium and eating healthy. And
so I don't know exactly what's right, but I'll tell you what I make of all of this. I think that there was a scare about taking calcium as a result of a study that was published last year in the British Medical Journal showing that there seemed to be a trend towards some increased cardiac events, that everybody immediately stopped taking calcium, but we need calcium. So I think having a healthy amount of calcium in the diet is good. Whether or not it's necessary to supplement is something that that each one of us needs to discuss with our physician. In general, we have to eat, and we have to eat now, and we don't perhaps have all of the answers, but I think that a healthy diet is a diet that is rich in naturally occurring vitamins. I'm a big believer in fruits and vegetables, and that's kind of the diet that I follow, and I advise people to follow, perhaps limiting the consumption of animal products, especially meats and especially red meats is just also good advice. But I think that we're very far from knowing exactly how much of each food group to use, and perhaps some of it is determined by the way each one of our bodies processes these foods. So I don't think, again, there's going to be one answer that satisfies everybody with diet. I don't know anything that's specific to Jarlsberg or Gouda. I think they're good sources of protein, and if you enjoy them, by all means, eat it.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been extraordinary. This has been an amazing call. And I also want to thank all of you who have asked questions either on the phone or online and really enhanced our call by your questions. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning a program like this, we all recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I want to reiterate some of the points that Pat made, that this is, of course, these services are offered by Cancer Care, that we are an organization that offers lots of support to people living with cancer. And we have very specific also programs that help women living with breast cancer as well. We have a staff of 45 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services from practical and financial assistance to support groups and counseling services. We have lots of different types of support groups, both on the telephone and online. And we also have, of course, these education workshops, a way to get information very quickly. And we have informational booklets and fact sheets. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with breast cancer. I do want you to feel you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. And we are simply a phone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE, or please visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Please do take advantage of these services. That's what they're here for all of you to get assistance that you may need. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.